transformation.
So we come and look at the idea of how to purify the mind, that's what this is all about. And the time when we overcome this thing or that thoughts. If we're looking at that, and this is one of the most crucial aspects of the Buddha's path, the ability to direct our mind in the right direction. Yeah? So this is actually very useful. I'm going to continue to talk about that quite a bit. As I mentioned yesterday, the most important things to overcome, the most, the worst kind of defilements is ill will, just anger, and that sort of thing. And it's very, very, very problematic, both in my thoughts and contribute, but also for other people's contribute. As I would have said, it's relatively easy to overcome anger, much more difficult to overcome that sensual desire. So that reason is kind of very, very most of the message. And also much more problematic. So I want to look at that, and this might be the sutras that I'm going to look at, is one of the sutras I read out of every related. Yeah? So then maybe you will have heard it before. But personally, I like to repeat things, I like to repeat it again and again and again. Because it kind of starts in country, it takes time for these things to become really useful. And that really has my mind to do things many times over again. So this is a for some of you will already know this sutra, for some of you may not. So I have a good at this. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. So Anguttara Nikaya. It's why it's called the Anagata of the Nodana Sutra. Anagata, which is really the ill will of all examples. And this sutra is offered by the Venerable Sankhuta of the Buddha. So he is kind of the Buddha's right hand man. Yeah, and the Buddha always praises him for the Sankhuta very highly. And he says that the final key is Dhamma, then the Venerable Sankhuta is the one that who can keep the wheel of the Dhamma rolling in the world. He was like almost level with the Buddha in terms of wisdom. And so this is what happens. There, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Friends of the bhikkhus, friends of all the bhikkhus replied. And the Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment, by which the bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has to do with anyone. But here, a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment from such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time begins an opening of the mind, sensitivity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, sensitivity of the mind from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, sensitivity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So you have five kinds of people, and these five groups that encompass everyone. Yeah, which is bad news if there's someone you really don't like and you want to be angry with, it's bad news because everyone is included. You shouldn't be angry against anyone. You can't say, I make that for the whole world except for this one person. Yeah, it doesn't work like that. The whole world should include everybody. Yeah? This is the bad news, but it's also the good news because what it means is that it's possible to overcome anger towards everybody. Yeah? You never actually need to be angry with one person. But here again, you see this idea in the sutra, this very kind of nice way of writing the sutra. You have a summary, first of all. This is a summary of the five kinds of people. And then you have the exposition afterwards, and it's kind of expanded out. It's a way of helping us to remember these things. This is a very typical way that things are done in the sutra. It's called the Vibhanga. And Udesa and Vibhanga. Udesa is a summary of analysis or exposition bringing out of the details. This is what we have here. So, everyone is included, yeah? There's no, we cannot really afford, as a Buddhist, to have any enemies in the world. it's so nice. We don't have any enemies, yeah? Like everybody is your friend. And you don't really care what other people think about you. That is not really the point. Other people may be your enemy, they may not like you, whatever. But regardless of that, you are the friend of everyone. It's nice, yeah? You kind of shrug your shoulders. If other people don't want to be your friend, it's okay. It's their problem, it's not your problem. At least you're going to be kind to them. Something very beautiful about that. Ah! So, the first kind of person. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag nobody could see is a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is impure, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. And you will recognize here, this is some of the things that I have been talking about already, how to deal with people when you see, when you get upset with them, when you feel resentment towards somebody. Now, this is the idea that people tend to be complex. People tend to have many sides to their personality. And people have negative sides, they have positive sides. And often it's up to us to choose which side we look at a particular person. Very often we have kind of false finding mind. We tend to see the faults in people and in the world around us. And it's just a matter of training our mind instead of focusing on the faults. We have to focus on the positive aspects instead. It's just a training, really. It's just a bad habit that we always look at the faults. I don't know what it's like here in Malaysia, that's kind of my impression. It regularly most places that people see the faults. And it's just a habit of the mind, a bad habit of the mind. And if we learn to look in a different way, we actually see things differently. But very often we're influenced by society around us. And, you know, many people talk about faults, see faults, about the news or whatever it is. So sometimes we have to take the radical step, we have to think for ourselves a little bit. This is what this really kind of is about. So we focus on the good side instead. And it's not that difficult to do. It's something that we can all do. Especially if you have, you know, many friends, like friends in the Buddhist community, and friends who come here to the BTS. Very often there's so many good aspects to the seeing in people like this who come here to the BDM or they come to the Buddhist society or whatever it is. And there's so much goodness to be seen there. All you have to do is remember that. At the very least, people who come here, at the very least, they aspire to do something good. Yeah, at the very least, there is that aspiration there, that intention to be good. And that already is very powerful. Yeah, it's already a very positive thing. Anyone who wants to do the right thing in the world, and I think actually the majority of people in the world probably in one way or another want to be good, they want to be kind, they want to do the right thing. And one simple reason for that is because I think deep down we all know that when you're kind, you're happy. Yeah, you feel good about yourself. I think we all know that. Intuitively, we're aware of that. But then our conditioning stops us very often from being able to carry it out all the time. So once you remember that, once you see that intention there, and you see the good activities of people around us, actually, it is not that hard to have a sense of to turn your mind away from those little things. Those little things in ordinary life are not so irrelevant, really. If the big picture is good, that is what matters. So remember that. But it takes time, it takes training, and we have to remind ourselves of this again and again and again, and not to kind of make excuses, but really try to see this. And actually, it becomes very useful and very powerful. So, people have many different sides, and sometimes even if they have just a little bit of good qualities, we'll see that in a second, that already you can turn your mind towards that. So, in a sense, when you're building up a type of perception, and you store that perception in your mind, you have this good perception in your mind, you store it there, and whenever the negative perception arises, you pull that all the perception out, bang, and then you kind of evaporate the negative perception. This is what we talked about the other day, about annihilating and obliterating, dispelling the wrong perception and giving rise to the good one. This is what really is happening here. So this little simile here is actually also very nice, very beautiful little simile here, about the rag road, the bhikkhus. Have you seen the rag road bhikkhu before then? We got those in Vietnam when we were in there. Have you got rag road bhikkhus in Vietnam? We've got rag road bhikkhus. Okay, yeah. So, household the road, okay. These are very, very fun rag road bhikkhus actually. I used to have a rag road, When I was a young monk, I was a very colourful monk because I had all this. It was ragged, everything was kind of ragged, and I was gone. And I had it for so long, there was nothing left of the original rug. Nothing, it was just all rags, and just the water. And as I'm gone, I was raised, that's good, I traveled around the world with this rag, and people would look at me. It was very, very strange. So it's a way, especially in ancient India, in these days, cloth is not so valuable anymore. It's quite easy to get cloth, but cloth is quite inexpensive. Everybody can bring it more cloth, but it's quite easy to get hold of rocks. But in India, 2,500 years ago, cloth was an expensive item, it was hard to come by. And so some of those monks who wanted to live in a very frugal way, they would just pick up cloth, whenever they could find it. They'd walk along the roadside and they would find oil, the kind of old rag that was really dirty and disgusting. And they would pick it up and they would take the good part out. And they would go to the charnel ground, the charnel ground, which is where the corpses were burnt or they were just left out to be eaten or to rot away. And they would take the cloth off the corpse and use it for their own set. It's quite nice, isn't it? So you have to wash it well, you have to wash it really well before you use it, otherwise it's quite bad. And actually a story that's quite relevant to you, some of you might have heard this story before. It's quite a nice story. It's one that the monk who went to the charnel ground, I don't know if this story is actually true, but they're there in the suttas, in the vineyard. And this is the story of the monk who goes to the charnel ground there. And he sees the corpse, it's a very fresh corpse, it's been warm. So he takes the cloth off the corpse. And then as they do that, the corpse kind of comes alive and says, "Don't take my cloth. This is my robe, It's not old, it's not kind of 100%, it's kind of dead, but it's kind of the spirit is still there or something. And then the monk sees it, you're dead, shut up, you're dead. He doesn't actually, I suppose I add a little bit to this story, just to make the point kind of interesting. And then he takes the cloth, and then he starts walking away. And then the corpse gets up, like a zombie. Going after the monk. And then he follows after the monk, and the monk looks over his shoulder, and the monk gets getting a bit concerned and starts running. And he runs back to his duty, and he slams the door, and when he slams the door, the zombie falls down outside, and the ghost kind of evaporates, and the thing is gone there. This is, I think, this is the origin of all the zombie movies, It started in Buddhism. Buddhism is kind of the source for so many unknown things in this world, including the zombie. This is the first recorded zombie incident in the history of the world. It's found in the Buddhist sutras. So then, why is the story there? And this is actually part of all the sub-stories to Parajika. Number two is about not stealing. You're not supposed to steal. I don't know, if you steal, you're no longer a monk. So the sub-story is this story. And then the monk goes to the Buddha, I did this. What
what does that mean? To commit the Piranha account, because that's so, you know, that is not the Piranha account. You just take it and share that it's not the problem.
So, wasting the course is kind of cool down a little bit. Yeah? If you want to warn them, and then you can take the course. That's the story there. It's amazing what you find in the Vinaya and the Sutta. There are remarkable stories in there. That is one of those. So but anyway, this was how the monks would live, and they would often get cloth from various places, and they would sew it together, and then they would make a rag roll out of it. Very simple, yeah? Nobody would ever steal a rag roll. That's one of the advantages of that. Nobody would ever look at it twice. That was a great thing. So this symbol here is about this monk who walks along the roadside, and then sees the rag in the road, yeah? And then what does he do? What he does, when he sees it, and he presses it down with his left foot and spreads it out with the right foot. Yeah? To get an overview, you want to see this rag, okay, it's that size, and you want to see which is the good part and which is the bad part. This is a similar kind of thing that we do with a person. We look at the person, not just look at one part of the person, we look at the whole personality. We try to see all the aspects of the person. We see the bad qualities, we see the good qualities, we see the in-between qualities. So we come to get that kind of overall sense, yeah? What this isn't just kind of symbolizes. So you do that, and then you tear on the section which you detest, and you take that with you. Yeah, so you look at this person, you see all the qualities, and you kind of tear off the bad qualities. Yeah? Imagine it's kind of written on a piece of paper. You tear off the bad qualities. What do you do with the bad qualities? You check it out. It's rubbish. Yeah? It is not useful. It is kind of bad. So you throw it out and you get rid of it. And then you take the good qualities. You take them in your heart. And these are the positive perceptions. These are the good qualities. You take them within your heart and you carry them with you. And then when you need them, because you need to counteract the negative perception, you bring them out and you remind yourself of the good qualities. So don't carry the rubbish around with you. Carry only the good things around with you. Because the other stuff is rubbish. It is not useful on the spiritual path. It is useless. So at this point, people often ask the question, well, is this being realistic? And come on, people have good qualities, they have bad qualities, yeah. So how can we be realistic and just look at the good ones and kind of throw away the bad ones? That is not being real, yeah. It's being living in a fantasy world. Okay, and that is in a sense, it is a good point, but you have to remember here that regardless of how we look at people, that our way of relating to anyone else is through our own conditions. What one person sees in somebody else, and what another person sees in exactly the same person are vastly different. So you take a person here, one might be the person's friend, and somebody else might be this person's enemy. They're seeing completely different things in the same person. So what is the real person? Is there any reality that we can kind of point to and say this is the real person? Or is there just different perceptions depending on your relationship with that person? And of course the reality is that there's just different perceptions. There's different ways of regarding this person depending on our conditioning. We have been conditioned in a certain way. That's why certain perceptions arise inside of us. So you can argue there isn't really any real person there. In any case, if you know what it means, you know, what a person actually is, a person is a constantly changing thing, yeah? We're never the same two minutes in a row. 1 minute we may be upset about something, the next minute we are the most loving and kind person, and then we are kind of neutral, and then we are generous, and then we have the desires, and then we want to become an elastic, and then we're just kind of moving around, kind of this, we have this sea of kind of shifting emotions, always moving around. So which one is the real one? So if you see the person that you're unlucky, you see the person getting angry twice in a row because of bad timing or whatever. Another one sees a person being really kind twice in a row. You have a very different perception of that person. So there is no real person. Yeah, and this is why in Buddhism we have this idea of the three kinds of conceit. The three kinds of conceit, the superiority conceit, the equality conceit, and the interiority conceit. Which all has to do with how we relate to other people. And according to Buddhism, all of those conceits are wrong. Because we cannot compare each other
with anyone. We can't compare each other. Why? Because there is no essence. There's nothing in us which is comparable to something else. We are just like this wave, always changing, always moving around, hopefully changing in a kind of positive direction, generally speaking. But there's nothing inherent in us that is comparable to other people. And this is such a beautiful thing when you start thinking like this, because it means that, you know, we're opening up that comparison and conceit, that being better or inferior. And I know the idea of equality conceit. They're not even equal. But there's something beautiful about that, because we stop all this measuring of people and we kind of become accepting of everyone, regardless of the status, regardless of who they are, regardless of whether they're handicapped, poor, wealthy, stupid, rich. All of that, nationality, all of that goes by the wayside. We accept people as people, regardless of gender, another important thing. And then, when you look at people just as people, I have been in that position before, I might get there again in the future. You start kind of thinking, comparing this way. It's very powerful and very beautiful. I have given it, sometimes I go to Curtin University in Australia, they have sometimes invite monks for special kind of talks, and you give a lecture on something. One of the lectures I've given is a human rights lecture at Curtin University. They invite different religions to give it an idea of human rights from a kind of Buddhist perspective. And one of the things I say is always this idea that we can't really compare each other, We can't say that one person is better than someone else. And because of that, in a very profound sense, we are all kind of equal, in the sense that we are all kind of moving, always changing, and no comparison is really possible. And that is a very good basis for non-discrimination, not discriminating against anyone, regardless of the background. Because you can't compare, you can't really say that one is better or worse than someone else, at least in the big picture of things. And it's a very useful thing. And this is kind of the idea here, and when we remember that, we start to understand that judging someone else is actually impossible. We never know who they are. They're always a changing entity. And then we have to take a completely different approach. We have to ask ourselves a completely different question. Instead of asking ourselves, what is the right way? What is this person? Instead, we ask ourselves the question, what is the most beneficial way of looking at this person so that the spiritual qualities inside of me can grow? This is a much, much better way of thinking about people, rather than thinking that, you've got to be realistic. Actually, there is no realism. There is no correct way of perceiving someone. So we ask instead, what is the most beneficial way of looking at other people? And the most beneficial way of looking at other people is always to remember, always to look at their good qualities, always to see the positive. Why? Because it actually enhances your spiritual growth. In the end, ultimately, what is the right way? What is the right way of actually looking at someone? If you are the Buddha, for example, you're an Arahant, what is the right way of looking at people? And the right way, actually, is always compassion. That is the right way. That is ultimately the right way. Why? Because if there is no self, and we are all suffering as we are in this world, we cannot find our way out of the suffering then. And we're kind of blinded by ignorance and tempted by craving. There's only one possible response to that situation, and that is compassion. And that is why the Buddha had compassion for the world. In the meantime, we do our very best to look at people with metta, seeing their good qualities, until we can reach the Buddha's way of looking at things.
Thank you.
Yes?
I understand about why they're not superior. I think
we're equal,
but I think
we're equal.
Equal, okay. Yes, the people always say we're all going to be, we should love each other.
Yes.
That's the
people
of which
only. Yeah.
So, anything like,
but
not.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So, I'll just repeat the question. We're saying that you can understand that, you know, we are shouldn't think in terms of superior or inferior. But why not equality? Why aren't we equal with each other? And the reason is because when you make any kind of judgment, when you compare yourself to anyone at all, you need some kind of measuring yard, to say why you are either better or worse or equal. So there is no real measurement. Okay, so now in this moment, you know, in one moment you might be equal to somebody in the sense that you have a similar emotion. In the next moment you don't have a similar emotion anymore, so you're actually different from that person. Yeah? And then moment down the line, and one person might be drawing in good qualities, and another one might be declining in good qualities. So there's so many different factors kind of moving together. You cannot actually say whether, you know, you cannot actually compare, because there is no basis, there is nothing in you which is the real you that you can compare to somebody else. It's always just changing things. So equality is also a misunderstanding if you say equality in an absolute sense. But I think in a broader sense, you can say that we are equal in the sense that we are all these changing currents. Yeah? So one day you're better than someone else. This moment maybe better because you have more kind thought. Next moment you're worse. But in a sense we are equal because we're all these streams of consciousness, streams of experience going through the world. And it's a deeper kind of equality there. And I think that is where the idea, I think, of human rights comes from. Because one of the problems with human rights is that how do we, you know, can we say that we're all equal? If you look at the world, it doesn't look like we're all equal. Yeah, it looks like we're very different. Some people are kind of born poor, some wealthy, some intelligent, some stupid. It looks like we're very different. But in the big picture, actually, things actually change. Especially if you look from lifetime to lifetime. Yeah? One life you are a woman, next lifetime you're a man, and you're a woman again. So how can you discriminate? The point is that all of these potentials are already within us. You know, the potential is already in you to be a man or a woman. The potential is already in you to be born in every kind of being I think of on the planet. The potential is already in you to be born handicapped in a future life. Yeah, it's already in there. It is already part of you, because the potential is there. How can you discriminate with people who are in that situation? Yeah? You discriminate against yourself. Because you already, it's already inside of you, waiting to come out. So once you look at it like that, you know, you start to become much more accepting of people, all stations of life, all different areas, because you are no different. Anyway. So, yes,
sir. You just mentioned that there's no discrimination. I thought there's some discrimination against human beings. Even if you look at the 31 days of existence, above the level of the Deva, the Brahma, there's no ladies. The all men. The higher level of all men. It's like the body
characters. It's not actually the case. In the normal there is gender difference. Yeah, you can have a gender, you have a feminine, and have the masculine. But yes, you're right, it comes a point when gender disappears. But the moment gender disappears, it's not like you're all men, it's all that you're neither man nor woman. you transcend gender, you go beyond gender. So the Brahma Lokana, you are neither one, you're neither one nor the other. And that's why you go into the deeper your meditation is, you also transcend gender. There comes a point in the meditation when you are nothing anymore, you're neither man nor woman. All you are, you're bliss. What is that bliss? Is that male or female? It doesn't make any sense to talk about it in those terms anymore. So go beyond that. And this is one of the wonderful things about the higher states of meditation.
So the arahant is made of men?
Well, they are physically, obviously, they are still outward, they still have a gender outward, but mentally they are not recognizable. They go beyond that, they go beyond gender, in the mental world. Yeah, they are asexual. I mean, they don't have any interest in any kind of sexual thing at all. They go beyond that. So you're no longer men or female, you're beyond that. And it's true, there is gender discrimination in the Buddhist world, but that is just like the social convention that we have. Yeah? It's got nothing to do with the Buddhist kind of teachings. This is just kind of the worldly stuff, and the worldly stuff is not like that. That's true. Yeah, so maybe we should have it, you know, maybe we should, that's good enough. So I hope that makes sense. So, this is what this is about. So in the end, we ask ourselves the question, instead of asking ourselves, what is the reality can never be found, we ask ourselves what is useful. And what is useful
is that always, you know, the idea of moving away from defilement, moving towards a pure mind, because that is what ultimately is going to lead to insight, to understanding, to samadhi, and all of these kind of things. So we learn to see the good side of people, like, and when you see the good side, then you are doing what you should be doing, and also learning to see compassion as well. This is the right road that you have. You tear that away and you carry that with you into the future. And this is the great thing about this. So there you are. That is the first one. Then we have the second one. Second one is as follows. How friends should present the computer mode towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure. Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here, it's very similar to the previous one. The only thing they do is kind of swap around bodily behavior and verbal behavior, but the idea is exactly the same. So the main thing here is just that the simile is quite different. So here you come, there's a pond covered with algae and water plants, yeah? What is the pond? The pond is like a person. So covered with algae, the algae here is a symbol for the defilements, yeah? Water plants and algae are not defilements, they're kind of bad qualities that you see in that person, rather. Yeah? You see all these bad qualities. And then this man arrives, afflicted and oppressed by the heat. This is the fault-finding person, yeah? He only sees this algae and water plants. And doesn't see anything else. And being oppressed by the heat here is the metaphor of being angry. Yeah, when you're angry, you're hot. And not only are you hot when you're angry, but you get weary. Anger makes you tired. Yeah, after you've been very angry with someone, you often feel tired afterwards. You kind of just want to want to have a rest. And you are thirsty and parched. So you are kind of here looking for, I suppose, a solution, yeah? So you're there looking for a solution for the anger. How can you find a way out of this? So what do you do? Well, this is what you do then, you plunge into that pond. You sweep away the algae and water plants with your hands. And you sweep away those negative qualities that you see there. You don't allow them to infest your mind. You sweep them away. And with your cupped hands, you drink of that water. You drink the good qualities. You take on board the good qualities. Yeah, so just like you, when you drink cool water, you cool down. When you take on board the good qualities of that person, you cool down as a consequence. The mind cools down and you feel really nice and easy after that. Yeah, it's a beautiful simile. You take all these things on board and you carry it around inside of you afterwards. Cool water traveling around. It's really kind of a very nice way of thinking about it. So what is the difference between this one and the previous one? One talks about looking at good verbal qualities when they are bad bodily qualities. The one talks about looking at the good bodily qualities when they are bad verbal. What's the difference? And the difference is just that people change over time. Sometimes they have good qualities here, sometimes bad qualities there, and then these things change around. So wherever there are good qualities, regardless of what they are, that is where you place your attention. And this is what this is referring to. It doesn't mean, I don't think it means very much apart from that. This is what this second one is about. Yeah? Okay. But you can see here, the idea is always the same. You look at the good qualities, you sweep away the bad ones. And to be able to do that, you have to build up this perception inside of you of the good qualities of the people around you. Even in the monastery, you have to do these things, because in the monastery, you're very closely with other people. And even though they are monks, they're not perfect. You know, often they come up and say things that isn't quite right, or they do things
monastery, you have to learn how to sort of look at the people around you in this way. But again, it's quite easy, yeah? Because you live with people with good qualities who have the kind of highest aspirations. So it's quite easy to do this. So, and you learn how to see your fellow monks. Some of the nuns as well, they have to show their way, it's not such a problem. But you learn, especially the people who are very close to you, you learn how to see them in a good way. Let's go to the third one. And friends, how should we present from Guru Mukha towards a person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind? So this person is not so good at bad verbal behavior and bad bodily behavior, but from time to time we gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. This is the Chittasa Vibhana. And Vibhana is the opposite of Nibbana. Vibhana is like the hindrance of the mind. Vibhana is the opposite of the hindrance. It's the Vibhana that opens up instead of being contracted and smaller. So this is when the mind becomes pure. What is this harm as a kind of calming down and gets the purity of the mind and the consequence. This is what Vibhana means. So, how do we know that someone has this kind of mind state? Placidity of the mind, if the mind is kind of calm and relaxed, like a flat lake or something like that. How do we know somebody has this kind of qualities? And sometimes you just observe people, and you know that some people are okay, these are peaceful, and you can kind of guess roughly at the state of mind, and seeing what they are like. Amazing how much you can read somebody's mind just by observing them. And if you observe it carefully over a long period of time, you can roughly know what's going inside in their mind. So, there was one famous monk in China. He said, all this mind reading stuff is really overestimated. It's kind of overvalued. Forget about that. All you have to do is look at somebody, have a sweet, and straight away you know what the mind is like. So if you are really sharp and you know a lot about people's behavior and their minds, all you need to do is look at a little bit of the behavior and straight away you know if they have samadhi or not. So somebody has samadhi who's sweet very systematically and very kind of very peaceful fashion. And somebody who hasn't got samadhi will be people random and do things. And if you know the mind, know how this works, you can tell. You can see how someone is like it. Actually, that's what it says in the sutta. It says this. Three or four different ways of reading someone's mind. And the first way of reading someone's mind is to look at their actions. It doesn't sound like mind reading at all, but that's what it is. That is how we know that if somebody has mental freedom, the liberation from defilement. Sometimes people say that it's so dangerous. Here, this scallywag, this person, a bad verbal and bad bodily behavior, still they get actually the freedom from the defilement. Still, they get some good meditation every now and again. How did this happen? Why is it? Why do I try so hard? I'm doing the 5 days, I'm doing the car, I'm doing all my things. My meditation is coming together. This fellow over here, who is totally character, they're kind of getting good meditation. What's going on? And remember that the world is so complicated. We come from a time that is really inscrutable. Our conditioning in the past has been such that we actually deserve to get really good mental state. And then now, for some other reason, we're kind of heading in the wrong direction, doing bad things. Because our conditioning from the past is still carrying through a little bit. So we still have access to some good mental state every now and again. It's so complicated. Whereas for us, maybe we would be dodgy in the past, And then now we're finally coming around, so we're acting in the right way. And it takes a while for that current in our mind to actually have an impact on our minds. And this is why it is so complicated. But generally speaking, if you look around the world, it is the kind of people who will have good meditation. Generally speaking, but occasionally you find some dodgy character who also has good meditation. So, but generally speaking, there's a very clear kind of correlation between kindness, outward kindness, and inward peace of mind. Usually it's very obvious. So don't be quick to judge. If you are sometimes too quick to judge, you come to the wrong conclusion. So
So be a bit open-minded. Yes, you have a rough idea, bring to face your confidence and say that, but don't judge too fast, because it's sometimes you're just quite complex. So, this is the person who has just a little bit of good qualities and many bad ones. So. And this is what you do in this case. So, suppose there is a little water in a puddle. Then a person might arrive at a little bit of fresh tragedy, deeply thirsty and parched. And he would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gets an opening of the mind, the sympathy of the mind, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior or verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the passivity of mind he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here's the cow practice. You have got a cow. Yeah, you get down on all four, you suck out the water without kind of trying to take it up with your hands or anything like that. And you're able to get some clean water, because otherwise you will just stir it up. So the idea here is that sometimes people may have a tiny bit of good qualities. It doesn't matter exactly what they are. You need to focus very narrowly. If you look a little bit too much to one side, a little bit too much to the other side, you stir it all up, and the bad qualities come rushing in there, and then you can't really see. You can't really have makeup towards that person. If you want to focus on very narrowly, just see that one good quality in the person. You remember the one kind, the one act of charity they did, yeah, a long time ago. And you think, wow, isn't that wonderful? This person, so many bad qualities. Still, they were able to do one act of charity. You forget the natural bad qualities. And you think, whoa, what a wonderful thing that is. There's a nice story in the suttas about Venerable Sariputta and the Buddha. And there's a man who asks for the going forward. Yeah, he said, I want to become a monk. And then all the ones say, not that fellow, he's terrible. He's a good doctor, he's never really been supported. I don't want him to become a monk. And then Venerable Sariputta says, I'm actually there. I remember one time when he gave me an offering. Yeah, he put some food in my arms roller. And for that reason, I need support. He's got support. So here, he remembers one act of kindness, and he focuses on that. And there's a reason why Venerable Sariputta is now for teaching this particular sutta, yeah? He remembers that one act of kindness, and he has gratitude for that one act of kindness. We give one act of kindness, we shouldn't take it for granted. Why do we expect people to be kind to us? Well, you know, we don't really have any right to expect that, I suppose. So when someone is kind, actually we feel, wow, what a wonderful thing that is. And we remember that one single act, and then we can have meta towards people, even in this kind of situation, when everything else is bad. And the reason we can do this, partly, is because we are able to forgive the bad acts. We remember that the bad actions, well, you know, we have been caused and conditions, we may be conditioned to be the way we are in this world, because we have been conditioned to be the way we are, the conditions are so complex, there are often so many bad things perhaps happening in people's lives, yeah. Some people get brought up in families that are really abusive and of course you come out as a very difficult person at the other end, because your upbringing was so difficult. Not everyone has really nice and pleasant parents, or school teachers or friends or whatever else it is. So sometimes you think it's amazing that people even have, you know, a few good qualities. What a wonderful thing that is. And when you think like that, you can rejoice in people's good qualities, even if there's only one or two single ones. So you can focus very narrowly down on that good quality. Now what is kind of remarkable about this is the length to which Venerable Sariputta here goes to practice in metta, the length it goes to looking at the good qualities in someone. Yeah, why? What about compassion? What is that coming to this? But actually what he's saying is that you try
to use metta as far as at all possible. Yeah, even if there's a tiny little opening by having metta, we use metta. Why is that? And one of the things that you will see here in the sutta is that whenever the Brahma Vihara, the Brahmarandi divine bindings, just four of them, metta, karuna, mudita, and upeka, metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, and sympathetic joy, upeka, equanimity, they always occur in the same sequence. Metta is always first, karuna is always second. And as I said before, whenever the Buddha talks about kind of this sense and they have a certain sequence, there is a reason why there is such a sequence. It's not never random. There is a reason for that everywhere. All sense have a certain sequence. So why is there this sequence for the Brahma Viharas? And the answer, I think, is that with metta, you can never really go wrong. When you have metta for someone, if you see the good qualities in another person, you can never be wrong. Yeah? You always feel good and comfortable. You always make a positive contribution to your own spiritual life and also to kind of appreciating the other person. It's always a positive thing, no matter. You can never go wrong. But karuna, compassion, actually is more difficult. Because with karuna, sometimes you can see the suffering in somebody else. And sometimes if you get that slightly wrong, then you become slightly despairing a little bit. You see so much suffering in the world, and it can be painful, it can be hurtful. And because of that, it takes more skill to know how to use karuna in the right way than metta. Metta can never be wrong. Karuna can go wrong if you're not skillful in using it in the right way. In fact, in modern psychology, they tend to distinguish between two different emotions. One what they call empathy, and the other one is what they call compassion. And empathy means being able to feel with the other person. And so if the other person is feeling sad, you also feel a bit sad. It's like you empathize with them. When the other person is hurting, you also hurt to some extent in a similar way. It's kind of the empathy, the ability to put yourself in the place of the other. But compassion actually is slightly different. Compassion is really the wish for that person to be free of suffering. Yeah? If you see somebody in a very difficult situation, you want to help them. You want to free them from suffering. You don't necessarily put yourself in their place, fully understanding what is going on. It's more this wish to be able to free them. Then you'll be happy and well. Then you'll be relieved from suffering. Yeah? Now, if you empathize too much, you're going to get exhausted. Maybe you're going to be taking on all the burdens in the world. So empathy is not always all that useful. Sometimes it can be useful, but not always. Compassion, if done in the right way, is always useful. Because the wish to help someone else, the wish to free somebody from suffering, is always a positive feeling if you get it right. But if you take on board too much of other people's negative stuff, it just drags you down. And you end up just crying all the time. Oh, the world is too hard. And it becomes too painful. And you can't free your heart from those negative feelings. So this is what's happening here. This is why I think Meditabha Sariputta is emphasizing metta so much. Because metta, you can't really go wrong with metta. As long as you see positive qualities, it will never have a negative impact on you. So for that reason, try the metta if at all possible. Yeah? Focus a lot on that and seeing the goodness in the people around you. And if you do that, then I think you are doing really well. And you're going to, I think that's a very positive thing. And later down the line, you can have a use compassion more. But there is also there is a time to use compassion also. And this is what we're going to see next. This is the fourth way of the universe. And this is what's coming up now. How, friends, should resentment renewed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and who does not gain an opening of the mind, an acidity of mind from time to time? This is the first thing. So, anything good in the person, yeah? Absolutely nothing good. Everything is kind of dark, bad bodily, bad behavior, and also mind is clouded by defilements. So, there's nothing good there. And the first question I think we should need to ask, and we've kind of talking about before, how we perceive people. to somebody else, because he is all the bad qualities in somebody. You cannot really say exactly what that person is. We don't have access to be in the mind or actually or all the rest of it. So it's just our perception of the person. Another person may see good qualities in this one, but we are only able to see bad qualities. And this is already, I think, an important understanding that when we see bad qualities in someone and nothing else, it doesn't mean that the person is like that. It means that it's our perception. When we understand that, we actually allow, we can allow that person to grow out of that. We don't make it into some kind of fixed entity. They are bad, and they're kind of bad forever after. But you actually realize it is kind of a temporary thing is anicca, it's a permanent, suddenly it's all gone, and suddenly, you know, this person actually shows all kind of true qualities. And in this way, we actually allow other people to grow, we allow other people to change. We don't place them in boxes and say, okay, this is the way you are, and you are like that forever after. We allow people to change. And this is already a very, we're doing something very kind to other people by even allowing that much. We don't kind of judge them absolutely, that rather we open up the possibility of growth of people. Yeah, so instead of judging people, we judge acts. It's not you are bad, but it's like this was a bad act, yeah? Or that sort of stuff, which is a very skillful way of looking at people. So, this is our personal approach, yeah? This is our personal opinion. This is how we look at other people. We just see this person. Measure down qualities. And this is the simile which the Venerable Sariputta uses in this case. Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was standing along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the same highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter calamity and disaster right here. So when somebody has all bad qualities, this is how you look at them. Yeah, they are like someone in a desert, someone in the wilderness. They're traveling along some kind of road and there's nobody around. There's no doctor around, there's no food around, there's no medicine around. There's nobody to help you out. And then you see this person traveling along and they are sick. If somebody is sick, it's not their fault. Yeah, you don't blame someone for being sick, at least if you're sensible. You don't blame someone for being sick. And you, when you see that, you kind of feel, you feel compassion for somebody. How do you feel when somebody is sick and they haven't got anyone to look after them? Quite natural to feel a sense of compassion. You want to help, you want to support them in whatever way you can, because you realize that this person, otherwise, that they're going towards their own death or very serious suffering as a consequence. Yeah, so what happens when someone is ill like this? You have compassion for them. In exactly the same way, when somebody has all bad qualities, they're ill. Yeah, they are completely all over the place. They're heading towards tremendous suffering in the future. Where are you going if you have all these bad qualities? Well, you're going towards suffering right now in this life. You're going to feel bad about yourself. Yeah, feel terrible about yourself in this very life. Also, when you die, after you die, you're going to go to a very painful destination. So everything, you're creating suffering for yourself. And of course, someone who is creating suffering for themselves without really understanding what they're doing. Why? Because we all want to be happy. We all want to create happiness for ourselves. And yet this person, they're creating suffering for themselves, it means they are deluded. They haven't got a clue what's going on. They want to be happy, and they're creating suffering for themselves. The only way to react to a person like that is to have compassion for them. They haven't got a clue what they're doing. are blind, they are moving around in the world in darkness, not understanding what is useful, not understanding what is in their own best interest. They are acting for their own detriment, for their own suffering in the future. Then compassion can arise because of that. Yeah? And there's something very powerful about that, because you know, very often when we are confronted with somebody who is very difficult, so always have, they have negative qualities, and whenever you get into the presence, you go, oh no, I don't want to be with this person, it's just so, such a negative thing, and you feel hurt perhaps by the way they speak to you, and the way that all of their conduct is really wrong, you feel terrible about that. And the problem there is that we have too much, we're too self-concerned, too self-centered, we're thinking about ourselves, yeah? It's natural that we're thinking about ourselves. So please don't get mad about thinking about yourself. It's natural. We are closest to ourselves. So we tend to think about ourselves in this way. But what the Buddha or Venerable Buddha is suggesting here is that we change the focus. Instead of thinking about ourselves, we look at the other person and say, they are the one who have a problem. They are the ones who are really going toward massive suffering in the future. Yeah, okay, I have to bear with it for 5 minutes or whatever, then I can go. And then I can shrug my shoulders and carry on with something else. But they carry on this, they carry around this mind state with them all the time, creating suffering in this life and even more suffering in the future. So instead of being concerned about yourself, you're like turning the table, and you're instead looking at the other person and have compassion for them instead. It's a very different way of looking at people, looking at the world. And it's such a liberating way of looking at the world. When we focus on ourselves, it's kind of small, it's a kind of small little thing. We are, I'm being greedy and selfish, and the mind is contracted and small. You're in the world inside of yourself. But in this way, you open up and you have compassion for this other person. It's like compassion spreading out to the whole world. It's an expansive mindset. It's a mindset where you kind of you embrace other people rather than rejecting them. When you are greedy, you reject others, you focus on yourself, you embrace everyone. And it's kind of an open mindset, an open heart, which kind of takes aboard the whole world. And it's far more beautiful, far more powerful, far more satisfying. Find more happy state of mind when you have that way of looking at things. And it is possible, yeah? It is possible because you understand that the other person is deluded. Through their conditioning, they are incapable of seeing what is in their own best interest. Because they can't see what is in their own interest, they do crazy things, which lead to their own suffering down the line. It's a very powerful reflection that leads to, you know, compassion in this way. And this is the right way of using compassion in life. When you can't see anything good, that is when compassion comes in. People are like sick people. They are like crazy people. The Buddha said, every time you get angry, you are nuts. You are a little bit crazy. So, okay, so this, the last part here, the last very bit of this, just to summarize this thing, bringing it all together. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion, one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern. Yeah? Beautiful. Instead of getting angry, then you have compassion, sympathy, tender concern. Thinking, oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So with the breaking of the body after death, he will not be reborn in the chain of miseries, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. This venerable one here doesn't mean like the person, yeah? Sometimes the venerable one, ayasma means the one endowed with age, so it's like the old person, literally. And this is how the word venerable arises. But in this case, it's just a general word for anyone, yeah? Any person. It's kind of nice, even the person who's a real scallywag, you consider them like the venerable one. Yeah, this kind of shows compassion. Yeah, it's kind of beautiful in a certain way.
And I like the word way that this has been translated by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. This word that, you know, you encounter calamity and disaster, it says up there. The person who is traveling along, not finding anyone, calamity and disaster. And this is what this is. If you get reborn in the Bhagavad Destination, that's exactly what it is. It's like calamity and disaster. It's exactly the last thing you want, but you are creating for yourself exactly the very last thing you want in this world. And then you can see how this compassion arises and the consequence. So, try that. These things are very powerful, actually. And once you get your head around this, it changes your outlook so dramatically. After a while, you can't really get angry with people anymore. Yeah. All we can see when somebody does something stupid, you just can have, all we can have is some compassion for them. Because you know that they are doing sin again. You know that it's their problem. It's got nothing to do with you. You take the personal out of it, as I was saying yesterday. It becomes impersonal then. Their conditioning playing out, but it's got nothing to do with you. You just happen to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. And even if it is a family member who is difficult, yeah, still, it's the same kind of idea plays out. And it's not never personal, it's just the person's conditioning coming out. Anyway, last one. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards a person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure and who from time to time get an opening of the mind, the acidity of the mind? So here we have the saintly person, yeah, everything is good. The mind is peaceful and bright, the bodily and verbal behavior are good. All the things are kind of coming out in a really nice way. The saintly type of person, and still, we have resentment towards them. Yeah, this is kind of the problem sometimes. But if you get angry with people, even if they are completely saintly, then why do we get angry? Well, because of our own conditioning, our own kind of problems. You read the suttas, you read about the Buddha, people get angry to the Buddha. Yeah, there's a one that, classic example of that is the Akosaka Vanaraja. Akosaka means the one who kind of abuses people, yeah, so that Bharat Raja, the abusive, that was kind of his name, kind of a fortunate name, but then your nickname, the abusive. And he goes to the Buddha, all of his family, some of his family members have become monks, yeah, they have been converted by the Buddha. And he's really upset for the Buddha for converting his family members, not happy at all. So he goes to the Buddha, hey, you are the terrible, converting people, you. Anyway, I don't know what he said, but it's bad things to the Buddha. I was really angry with the Buddha. I should have taken the sutta out, but I haven't got it with me. So, and then the Buddha says to him, well, you know, if, you've probably heard this sutta before, but, you know, if you have a dinner party, you get all these people to dinner, they come to eat the dinner, and then after they have eaten, they're full, there is food left over. Who does that food belong to? Oh, it belongs to me, says Akosaka Vanaraja. In the same way, all this anger that you're kind of trying to throw at me, actually, it just belongs to you. You are the owner of that anger. Yeah. You know, because it's scared, yeah? Because the idea of ownership here means that actually you have to bear the consequences of that anger in the future. You own it. You own the consequences of that anger. The Buddha, he's pretty chill. He doesn't really, you know, if somebody gets angry with him, it's not the Buddha's problem, it's the other person's problem. Right? This is kind of, we're trying to follow the Buddha's example, but remembering very often when people are angry with us, they do bad things with us, it's got nothing to do with us in this particular case. But remember, also here, the point here being that even when somebody is very saintly, it is actually easy to get upset with them. And the reason why it's upset, because people who have deep insight into the Dhamma, they might tell you things that you don't want to hear. Yeah, they might say, actually, maybe look at it this way. Maybe this is the way of the world. What do you mean the way of the world is like that? I don't want to hear about that. It's too profound. It's challenging my assumptions too much. Challenging my reality too much. And when we are too challenged, our views get challenged. Sometimes it's just too much. We can't deal with it. And then we get upset instead. I've seen this happening many times. But that is our problem in that case. So be aware of that. And it's okay, you know, if you get upset with somebody sometimes, even if they are very saintly, don't feel bad about that. Just reflect about it afterwards and see if you can, you know, kind of navigate this in the right way. So, Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clear with smooth banks, and a delightful place shaded by various trees. You will notice now the pond has no algae, there's no water plants, yes? It's just beautiful water all the way around. That's because the person doesn't have any bad qualities. It's just good qualities in there, nothing else. Not only is the water cool, but even the banks around, yeah, are beautiful, with shaded with various kind of trees. So, you know what kind of trees? There would be maybe date trees or coconut trees. You need a coconut, and then kind of coconut drops down, and you drink the coconut milk, and you kind of chill, yeah? Something like that, like a tropical paradise. So, then, especially where I come from, in Norway, tropical paradises are very kind of attractive, because Norway is full of snow and ice. So, we see kind of the beaches lined with coconut trees. Wow, that's really nice. So, I grew up as kind of the idea of paradise for when you come from Norway. Yeah. When you come from Malaysia, it's not so. Well, it's quite the same, yeah? Maybe Norway looks like paradise. So. Anyway, suppose, so we've come to this thing, and then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched, yeah? So again, this man is angry, and he is weary because of that, and he is thirsty because he gets rid of his anger and heat. So you plunge into the pond. Now you don't even have to get rid of all the algae and water plants. Yeah, the pond is already so beautiful. So you plunge into it, and you drink and bathe. Yeah? And in other words, you take aboard all of these good qualities. And then after you have taken aboard those qualities, after coming out, you sit and lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So in this case, it's quite easy to take aboard all the qualities, to drink them aboard, carry them with you. And then after you do that, you just lie down on the beach, yeah, smooth banks, lie down under the coconut tree there, yeah, and you lie there in the shade. And you're close, you keep it close to the pond, because the pond is just there next to the beach. So what this symbolizes, I think, is that it's almost like you become a disciple of that person. Yeah, you realize, wow, this person actually has so many good qualities, and you feel really inspired, you feel uplifted by the presence. Afterwards, you don't want to go anywhere else. You want to stay there. You want to hang out. Please, I want to be a disciple. I can meet the Buddha. We meet some exceptional person who has practiced the path a long way ahead. And you just want to hang around. You want to be there. You don't want to go anywhere else. And you become the disciple of that person. So once your anger dies down, you see things clearly, then you know what the value of being in that person. This is your real Kalyanamitta. You understand that Kalyanamitta, the Sankhurisa, the superior person, see, we do talk about the superior person, yeah? The ones who have insight into reality, the Aryans. You understand that your entire life, your ability to practice the path, depends on that. Your commitment to perseverance is supported by being with superior people. Just like I was mentioning earlier on in this retreat, the very foundation, everything starts out with the Noble Ones. And from there, all your mental development, everything comes from that. And because you understand that, you want to hang out with this person. Yeah? So you read the sutta, you hang out with the Buddha, you hang out with the Noble Ones. And gradually, you grow as a consequence, and these things start to happen. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gives an opening of the mind, facility of the mind, on that occasion, one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to the pure verbal behavior, and to the openings of the mind and the facility of the mind that he gains from time to time. And there's just so much good stuff to attend to. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. Yeah, so when the person has so many good qualities, you feel confident around that person. Actually, this is the word Samantha Basalika, confidence, inspiring confidence in every way, is the word used here. And Samantha Basalika stands for the word used for Gardenia commentary. I don't know how it does it, but it's used in the word Gardenia commentary. And you can see how people take words from the sutras and then they use that to name the commentaries, this kind of thing. But the point here is that when someone inspires confidence in every way, you can inspire yourself. You feel confident because of that. And this is one of the reasons why it is so important that Buddhism continues to produce noble people in areas in the world. Buddhism is alive as long as there are areas, as long as there are noble ones, because Jesus is still alive. As long as there are no noble ones anymore, there are no Aryans. It's as if Buddhism has become a purely theoretical thing that we find in the books. But it's no longer tangible in the same way. You can no longer touch it in the same way as you can when there are people who actually are the living example. This is one of those things that I've always found in that, the power of Buddhism. It's a mixture of the ancient wisdom that we have with us and come from these ancient books, combined with a living example. If you just have the ancient wisdom, you don't have a living example. It's not dry. Yeah, it is the example is there, but there's nobody who actually lives it. You can't see it in actual practice. You don't even know it. It works anymore. Yeah, because you have to see it with your own eyes to know if it works. But the living example without the ancient tradition, then you get all kind of crazy stuff happening. You get people proclaiming themselves to be enlightened. Yeah, I'm enlightened, follow me. Wait, is that how enlightened people behave? Maybe not. Maybe it's a charlatan. Maybe it's not a character. If you people go around saying, I'm enlightened, follow me, there's good grounds for being the skeptical, yeah? Because enlightened people don't usually act like that. They don't say, follow me. And there are very good grounds for being careful then. There are so many dodgy characters around who kind of proclaim almost to be enlightened. There is a secret apparently going on TV now, I just heard about it. Somebody wrote about this in a blog somewhere, which is about Rajneesh Osho. You heard about Osho and Rajneesh? Yeah. And he's one of these very well-known spiritual charlatans that lived back in the 70s and 80s. He was the biggest customer in the history of Rolls Royce. Yeah? He had more Rolls Royce than any other single person ever had. He was supposed to be a spiritual leader. He was supposed to be fully enlightened. And he had all kind of dodgy affairs with his disciples. Everything, it was a real kind of example of how cults can go completely wrong and completely bad. And eventually the whole thing kind of collapsed. And he died in kind of circumstance or whatever. But it shows you how careful you have. And he was one of these gurus that kind of arose. He was Indian originally. He moved to the United States. And he arose out of nothing. And he had, obviously, he was quite charismatic or something. There was something about him that attracted people. And then before you knew it, it was all kind of, it was all over the place. And this is the danger when you are out of context. There's no context around which you have to fit into something. There's no ancient tradition there. You are just kind of a self-proclaimed guru. That is always much more dangerous. I'm not saying it is always wrong. And maybe some of these gurus are genuine, but very often it is problematic. Another one is the famous Maharishi Maharaj. You know the guy who was the guru of the Beatles? It's not an Indian guru. And there's another expose of him as well. All these things are available these days. And again, all kinds of crazy stuff happened apparently during these people, under these people. Of course, you have to be careful. You read some of the expose, and sometimes maybe you can't trust it. But just, I think in many of these cases, there's probably a lot of truth to what is happening there. This is why we have to be careful, and this is why it is so useful to have the ancient tradition combined with the modern or the living example. When we have an ancient tradition, what it means is that ultimately we all take the Buddha as our teacher. Yeah, that is really what it means. So nobody really gets too big. Yeah, nobody kind of becomes the final guru. The final guru is always the Buddha. That is a very great safety matter, because it means that nobody else is taken too seriously. That is why it's so good to go back to the sutras, why it's so good to go back to the early teachings. Because it gives you that standard which everyone else has to refer to. So it's one of the very I think, very positive things. And that is why sometimes I think that in Buddhism, in the present day, they had in the tendency in the Buddhism to be too much guru worship, yeah? Too much worship of teachers, individual people, rather than actually going back to the early sources and taking the Buddha himself and his Dhamma and our teacher. There's too much emphasis on individuals, emphasis on particular persons. So be very careful with that. And this is one of the reasons I personally really like to go back to the word of the Buddha. So, and there's another thing about the Buddhism which is very useful, and that is, you know, as monastics, we have a vinaya, we have a code of conduct. That code of conduct which was laid down largely by the Buddha, and you are supposed to uphold. Yeah, and that has the great benefit. If you are kind of a guru which arrives out of nowhere, you have no conduct, there's nothing to bind you. Because there's nothing to bind you, it's very easy to go astray. But as a monastic in Buddhism, you have a very clear code of conduct. And if you don't keep that conduct, then it is the job of the lay people not to support you in the same way that the support goes in fact as well. So everybody should have some idea what that code of conduct is, so that we know when people are practicing according to the Dhamma and when they are not. So you can see the benefit of that. It purifies Buddhism. It makes it strong. It makes it resistant toward all the scallywags and all the dodgy characters in the world. So there's lots of inbuilt safety mechanisms there. But it's also very useful to have people who inspire confidence, people who you feel have practiced the teaching in the right way, who manifest some of those qualities that you're supposed to experience, you're supposed to develop as you practice this path. That is also very useful. And one of the kind of little quotes in the sutta that I always find very interesting was that the Buddha says, even just seeing arahant in the world, seeing one person who is very fully enlightened, is a great blessing. Excuse me. And the reason why it is a great blessing, because when you see somebody who is special like that, it gives you an insight, a window to a different reality. Yeah, people aren't usually like that. People usually have defilements, people have problems. But when you see somebody who is consistently peaceful, consistently kind, consistently has a lot of metta, consistently always working for other people, never really getting angry, never having a desire, never really getting confused, yeah? When you see somebody with a great amount of purity, yeah? Really mean a lot of purity, yeah? And you see it consistently over a long period of time, it kind of opens your eyes. There's something there which is very beautiful, very profound, something that you think, wow, I too would actually like to have some of those qualities. So just seeing that, it opens a window to a different reality. And that is what is so powerful about this. Otherwise, all we have is our ordinary world. And our ordinary world isn't always so great. Yeah, we feel the need for something more. There it is, a visual representation of that other possibility. And that is what arahants and the Aryas, especially the arahants, are in this world. And that's why they inspire confidence in every way. If you are mature enough to get it, yeah, some people never get it, of course, then there is a problem. I think there's not kind of no way out if you are truly rooted. But otherwise, the possibility is there. Okay. These friends are the five ways of removing resentment, by means of which a bhikkhu can entirely remove resentment towards whomever it has arisen. So, here you are. That is that sutta. And I read it out every year. I always know it. It's weird. I read it out so many times. Yeah? I always know the sutta. I think it is such an incredibly useful and practical sutta. So, you're all happy with that? Yes, great. I'm trying. So, this session is quite long, it's 1.5 hours. So, it goes on for quite a while. So, I hope you are, if you have any feedback about that, you want to short it or whatever, please just approach Bobby and show you can adjust the time table a little bit. Because 1.5 hours can be quite a long time, both to talk and also to listen. So, just see how you feel about that. But I was not there, actually, because now we're going to move on to some further sutras and drama. So please have a nice lunch, have a nice rest, and see you back again. See you.